Welcome to the Vernuccio Novak Report and the American Political Zone. From New York, this is Frank Vernuccio.
And from Washington, this is Daria Novak.
It's been quite a week, Daria. Two things that occurred, I think, that kept everyone back on their heels. One, of course, was the assassination of Charlie Kirk. And the other, of course, was the Russians flying drones into Ukraine, Romania, and apparently Lithuania as well. Let's go to the first. I think what happened with Charlie Kirk was, in many ways, for many folks, an illumination. For a long, long time, we've seen startling rhetoric coming from the left. We were called Nazis on the right. We've been called many things. Everything short of saying that we should be shot. And then they did shoot one of the leaders on the right. But I think they erred substantially. I think what they really did was awaken, as a Japanese admiral once said after Pearl Harbor, they've awakened a sleeping giant. On college campuses throughout the United States, I don't think conservative or moderate students are going to take being slapped around by the left any longer. They're not going to take it when left-wing professors fail them intentionally because of their views. They're not going to take it when college administrators tell them they can't have their political events on campus the same way the leftist students do. They have awakened a sleeping giant.
You know, you're very correct, Frank. And I think it goes beyond college campuses. We are seeing people who made horrific comments praising the assassination of Charlie Kirk get fired from their jobs by corporations. We've seen people who have gone out and taken these social media posts and brought them to companies and said, "Do you support this, what your employees are saying?" And we're starting to see the corporate world too react and say, no, it is not okay in a free society to curtail free speech through violence. You know, I think this really, you know, we've talked about this as on off air, Frank. It is a turning point, no pun
It is
intended.
indeed.
It is, I think, one of the biggest ones that we've seen, probably. Maybe in my lifetime, I don't know, but I have been looking at social media this week and looking at videos from places as far away as New Zealand, Eastern Europe, whether it's Canada, all over the world, people are gathering. They know Charlie Kirk's name. They're calling for peaceful assembly. And I want to point out to our audience, to me, this is one of the big differences between the extreme left and the right. When something happens to one of the people on our side, we hold prayer vigils. We're peaceful. We gather. We pray. What do we see happening on the left? Burn cities, burn stores down, police stations, shoot people, fires everywhere. It's destructive. I think that we can see that the right is the one that protects free speech and treasures it. It could be more.
Charlie Kirk in particular, his message was always talk to each other. You couldn't have a more inappropriate target for political assassination. Not that there's any appropriate target ever for political assassination, but Charlie Kirk was the guy who said, always talk to each other. Let's talk this out. For him to be the target of an assassination indicates to me the moral total bankruptcy of the left. And when so many leaders on the left have refused to condemn this, when, for example, in Congress, there was, I believe, Mike Johnson wanted to have a moment of prayer to commemorate what happened to Charlie Kirk, some of the Democrats actually objected to it. I think Charlie Kirk is exposing as much in death as he did in life. There is a huge difference between the way one side of this political spectrum operates and the way the other side of the political spectrum operates. And Derry, I'm glad you brought up about what's going on around the world. This past week, and we should not neglect to mention it, in the United Kingdom, there were massive demonstrations in favor of free speech. Free speech has become such an endangered species in the UK that even flying an English flag or the British overall flag was considered an act of public disruption, and people were going to jail for it. people who pointed out crimes, for example, rapes committed against young girls by immigrants, or not illegal in Britain, but by immigrants, was considered almost a hate crime. Around the world, the entire Western ideal of free speech, embodied no place else like it is in the United States, is being assaulted by left-wing governments. There is a counter-reaction to it. There has been a counter-reaction to it. The assassination of Charlie Kirk is, I think, illumination and bringing this even more into the public eye.
It is, and there's something that we have to remember. There are some Democrats and some left-leaning individuals who are saying that this is an assault on free speech. What we're talking about is not agreeing or disagreeing with what Charlie Kirk said, but the attack on free speech. The radicalized left, the extremists, the progressive left are the ones that were making the horrific claims and laughing on air, posting
Yeah.
videos, posting jokes about this death. I think rational, sane people who may or may not agree with his viewpoints are coming out now and saying, like it or not, this is free speech. And something else, I've had not seen that much of Charlie Kirk in videos from his events. Frank, I went through a lot of hours of his videos, and time and again, I saw where he quieted the crowd when the crowd didn't want to hear somebody who was on the opposition side. And Charlie Kirk said again and again in these videos, let them talk. Let's hear what they have to say. To me, I can't think of a better person than somebody who was politically, than somebody who was saying, let's get everybody together and talk and figure out the answers to the problems that we have. And I could not believe when some of the left came out and called him names like a racist. I saw
Right.
the video where Charlie Kirk says there is no such thing as race. It's a construction. Some of us have a social construction. Some of us have more melatonin in our skin, some have less. This should not be something that divides us. We all have DNA. We're all human. When you look at these things and the left just totally ignored it. Now, I get it. Some may not like some of his conservative Christian views. That's okay. People have a right in this country to disagree, but we also have a right to freely speak and to be safe. Charlie Kirk was not given that right.
Yeah, I want to bring up one other point while we still have time. I am sick and tired of the utter bullcrap that violence is an equal problem on both sides of the political spectrum. That is totally nonsense. There is no conservative equivalent of Antifa. There is no conservative equivalent of Black Lives Matter. Absolute nonsense. Are we perfect on the right? No, of course not. But there is no equivalent of what the left has done in terms of violence. Charlie Kirk was assassinated, a man of peace. There are no cities burning. There are no calls for heads to roll. There is no riots in the streets. If it had been a left-wing figure, the cities would have burned, just as you mentioned before, Daria. So the nonsense that both sides are at fault in this bringing an environment of violence is a lie. It's a lie that's continuously repeated. Now, one of the few folks on the left that I do think has some rationality, that tends to try to be fair, is a guy named Bill Maher. And yet, even Bill Maher is propagating this lie that violence is a problem on both sides. No, it is not. It's a lie that has to be put down, has to be completely refuted, refuted peacefully, because that's what we do. There is a reason why the left turns to violence and the right does not. We have the truth on our side. We're not afraid to put forth our arguments and our beliefs because there's a whole history of them being right. But on the left, socialism has been a failure for 120 years, and yet the left continues to push it. When you expose someone's falsehoods, they get violent because they can't turn to logic. They can't turn to honesty. They turn to violence. That's what we're all about. Jerry, let's go to our first guest. Bill Walton, known as America's Common Sense CEO, is the host of The Bill Walton Show. Bill, welcome to the program.
I think you're on mute, Bill.
How's that?
There you go, Bill. Welcome back to the program. Good to see you again.
Hey, how are you?
Fantastic. We saw among the other startling shows as news this week, Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and Kim Jong-un get together. I think Americans still have this mentality that it's the early 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union when, the world is at peace. And we had that idiot book written about the end of history as we know it. Are we still operating under an illusion that these are peaceful times when, in fact, we see three powerful nations, three nuclear powers, clearly ganging up against the United States and the West?
Well, too many people are suffering from that delusion, including an awful lot of people in the Biden State Department and Victoria, led probably by Victoria Nuland. And these were the same people that when the Soviet Union fell, I think it was 19, was it 1991? They refused to reach out to Russia to say, "We understand the Communist Party's gone. We'd now like to begin working with you." There was no Marshall Plan. There was no trying to integrate it in the West. Instead, they cracked down on it, and they ended up with oligarchs instead of a working liberal democracy. And I think what's happened to Russia can be, the blame can be laid an awful lot at our feet, and Britain's, and a lot of the other European countries that have been hostile to it. And now, where are we, 35 years later or so, people are, people are waking up to the fact that Russia is surviving, notwithstanding their, their hurt economy and the world war in Ukraine. But China's very much emerged, and now we have India and some of the other countries, and they're really sort of, I'd call them the global East. They've emerged as economic powerhouses, and we have to deal with that.
Bill, you've been in the business world your whole life. From what you know and from what you can garner from talking to people, do you think there is any way to peel Russia away from China? Obviously, Russia today is the junior partner in that relationship. We see that China can make demands. China can use Russia to keep the West busy, occupied while it does what it wants. Can we pull Russia away at this point? Or are there so many levels of oligarchs and Putin lookalikes coming up that it's just going to go on?
Well, there's certainly a lot of Putin lookalikes that could come onto the stage, but there are an awful lot of people who are not. And yes, I think there's a lot of ways that we can build bridges with Russia. And I don't think we've done any permanent severing of ties. And of course, the Russians and the Chinese have been eyeing each other warily for decades, centuries. And so what happened was, when we sanctioned Russia, Russia immediately turned to China, started selling its hydrocarbons to China, and also now to India. And so in a way, we created those alliances that we saw a couple of weeks ago in Tianjin. And if we want to, I think we can begin to undo that. We've already beginning making progress with India. And the thing I like about Trump, and I guess that it's my bias as a businessman, he's a business guy. He wants to make deals. To do deals, you can't be shooting at each other. And you have to figure out where your comparative advantage are, and sell to each other, and build his idea of building a resort in Gaza is probably the most extreme example of how he wants to turn the world from a war zone into a vacation land. I think it's possible. I also think it's possible to build some bridges again with China. I think they obviously are led by a leader, Xi, who's been an implacable Marxist communist, a Maoist, and really, really extreme. And I think he probably the most extreme Chinese leader we could see. And if and when he goes, I think we've got an opportunity to rethink that relationship as well.
So, if we look at Russia, what does Russia have that would be good for the West? What could we provide to Russia? I'm talking in business terms. And I recognize it's a long term that we're not going to obviously have a political alliance with Russia anytime soon. But in the long run, is it natural resources or what is it that could draw Russia to the West and away from China?
Well, I think the first step would be to establish what on earth we want to do with NATO. It's not a business issue. I mean, the Putin's issue for the longest time has been the aggressiveness with which the European countries have wanted to expand NATO. And let's face it, if we had somebody including Mexico or Canada in an alliance defense alliance against the United States, we wouldn't stand for it. And so if you put yourself in his shoes, there's a lot of ways we could bring the temperature down. I think Russia has a lot of a lot of energy, so do we. I think we could help them build pipelines to we could help bring back Europe. The European economies are in terrible shape now because of their green energy self-inflicted plight. And with Russia, I need to think about it a little bit. They've got a pretty good tech industry. They've got so much of their economy now on a war footing. I think we'd have to we'd need some time to sort it out. But the Russians are smart people, and it's a culture that's attractive in many ways. And so, yeah, I think we could.
The Russians do one thing better than anybody else on the planet: suffer. One of the things,
Don't forget
what,
vodka.
yeah, true. One of the things that never seems to have occurred, either on the government level, Democrat or Republican, or on the business level, or on the academic level, is try to lay out the case to Russians that they'd be so much better off being allied with the West rather than opposed to the West. Certainly, it's kind of ironic, I think, to think that the West has any designs for a Napoleonic type invasion of Russia. That's not going to happen. I think it's clear it's not going to happen. On the other hand, the Russians aligning with China is really a devil's deal. The Chinese and the Russians do not have the same futures, I think, in their minds.
No.
The Chinese look with envy at Russian land space and Russian resources, and there's no real future alliance for those two. And yet, neither in government or academia have I ever seen any real appeal to the Russian people saying, for God's sakes, wake up. You could be so much better off looking to the West than looking to the East. Why not?
Well, it brings me back to what I said at the outset. There's been an enormous bias against Russia among the foreign policy elite in this country and in Europe. I mean, their irrational hatred of Russia and Putin is something that mystifies me. But I think that could, the regime has changed. A lot of those people are out of power, and Trump is bringing new people in, and I think Trump can help to build the bridges. It's going to start with leadership and the way Donald Trump approaches them. But you're right. I mean, China's got 1.4 billion people. Russia has 140 million. China has, the world's second largest, depending on how you count it, maybe equal to largest economy. And Russia is, as I think at last time I checked, it has an economy about the size of California. So it's not a You know, it's not a it's not a party, not a partnership of equals, and it'd be a real benefit to Russia to see it pulled into Europe, as opposed to China. And the cultural differences between Russia and Europe are not nearly as great as they are with China. So I think if you're thinking how people would get along with each other, I think that was definitely a direction I would be pushing it.
Isn't there a problem, though, in the terms of the Russian leadership, according to many who studied it intently, didn't really change that significantly. Once you got Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin out of the way, a lot of the old communist leaders simply changed the names of what they were from commissar to corporate leader. And essentially, it's the same people.
Well,
Vladimir Putin yearns for the return of the Soviet Union. He said that very much from the outset.
I think it's a mistake to think that the rest of the world needs to look like us. I think the business of democracy promotion and exporting what America has, it does not export very well. I mean, there are very few countries in the world that have a Democrat tradition like ours, have a constitution, was born in freedom. Most other countries have been dictatorships, forever. China had its emperors, and Russia had its czars, and India has had a bunch of princeling states running it, and most of the rest of the world does not look like us. And I think if we start saying, well, gee, if we're going to do business with them, they've got to have governance similar to ours. I think we're t starting off in the wrong place. Now, with China, what they're doing to the Uyghurs and the forced organ harvesting and things like that is unconscionable, and we can't really give them a pass on that, and we can't give them a pass on fentanyl. But I don't put Russia in that category at all. They're not remotely doing the sort of things that China's doing.
Right now, China has engineers working in the Himalayan mountains to build the world's largest hydropower dam. To me, water is a critical issue that is often overlooked in politics. For every glass of water that the Chinese have, we have five glasses, so to speak, of clean water, just on an average. This particular dam and its location will control water for much of the Indian subcontinent. Do you think that this dam, if I realize it's in an earthquake-prone area and there's a lot of geological issues in building it, but the Chinese build trains across permafrost, they probably will get this done too. Do you think that that is going to influence India's position in the world and its relationship with China in the coming years?
Absolutely. I mean, it's very aggressive, and China's already got that problem with the Southeastern Asian countries, Vietnam, Cambodia, et cetera, et cetera. They've been taking water from them for years, and that relationship with India is going to be extremely strained. The thing to keep in mind about the Chinese is they can't help themselves. The Politburo has all nine members are engineers. And most of the top people in government in India, I'm sorry, China, are trained as engineers. They like to build stuff, and they've overbuilt that country dramatically. And I think this dam is probably just the latest example of their mindset. I don't know. I think there's a lot of diplomacy, a lot of working out of how this water's used and where it goes, or this could turn a couple smiling faces at a conference into a hot war. It's a flashpoint, and I think it's something that we've got to be watching and try to be helpful to make sure they don't get at each other in a way that hurts the rest of the world.
We're seeing also with this particular dam and the control of water, it could stop India from development of its rare earths. We're seeing that the water that the Indians are using right now comes from areas that would be impacted by the dam. This particular dam project seems to be indicative of what China does everywhere. There's some kind of ulterior motive or goal. Do you think that the Chinese can change culturally? You say after Xi Jinping is gone, but Xi Jinping, it's time for his legacy, be that Taiwan or whatever. But the next leader that's coming up is going to be in the same pattern, most likely, of Xi Jinping, probably another technocrat. Can we break that pattern? Do you think we could see a pattern broken?
I think the only way we could break it is that, we were starting to do this, and then Xi got so aggressive with shutting down their free market economy in China to the extent they had one, is to try to establish some business relationships, reestablish. The Apple iPhone, 95% of it was made in China, or made the key components were made in China. And I think commercial relationships are one good way to keep up a dialogue. But the Chinese have a habit of annoying their neighbors. I can't think of a single country with the absence, with maybe except North Korea, that has kind thoughts about China. They've been aggressive, not only on the continent, but they've been building pop-up islands from on top of garbage piles in the South China Sea. And so their expansionism, it seems to be I don't know quite how you stop that. And of course, they think they're justified. They talk about their century of humiliation, which is when the British, and the Americans started really the Opium Wars, and really just tremendously ripped apart the social fabric of China. And that lasted really until 1949, when Mao took over, and he did not make it better, but at least he made them feel pride in China. And they teach that in school, the center of humiliation and their right to reconquer the what they call the Middle Kingdom. That's going to be very hard to change. We don't have any choice but yet to try to mitigate that. And that's why I'm in favor of just going a little further off the field here. To we think about artificial intelligence. I'm in the camp that we're better off selling some of the chips to China, getting them involved in our technology, the stack as they call it, and having them codependent on us in technology development, rather than having them invent their own technology from scratch. They've no longer ceased. They've ceased to be just copiers. They've become innovators, and so we need to watch that as well.
Speaking of North Korea, for a good part of our lifetimes, the United States and the Soviet Union stared each other down, despite the fact that we had vast amounts of nuclear weapons poised to launch at each other. We never did. What's the impact now of a, frankly, psychopathic kingdom like North Korea getting a really significant nuclear arsenal? Where do we go from there on that, particularly now that it seems that North Korea's nukes are being supported by perhaps Russian technology and Chinese assistance?
Well, Donald Trump charmed their president in his first term. Let's hope that Donald Trump can bring some of that charm to the second term. He was at the conference with Modi and with Putin and with Xi, and was treated in one ceremony as an equal to Putin, an equal partner. And I think his motives are ego. His motives are pride, prestige, being considered a big guy. And physically he's a little guy. He's sort of ridiculous, actually, but he is the fearless leader. I don't know. It's just we've got to keep, as what they say in The Godfather, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. I think continuing a charm offensive with him and making him feel like he's part of the world community is probably the best way to hold him at bay for the time being.
United Nations reports indicate that the North Korean people are really facing significant amounts of starvation.
Well,
What's the impact of?
have you seen the statistics, how much shorter and their body weight is, how
Indeed.
the starvation regime has been just unconscionable, and when you can see it that starkly, I think the South Koreans are probably 12 to 15 inches taller than the North Koreans.
You know,
Sorry, I
Bill,
interrupted your question, but I find it in the 21st century, it's unacceptable.
Bill, I want to propose a scenario to you in the future that some of my friends or colleagues in the intelligence community talk about. And that's this. China, as you know, is facing a number of challenges, some of which will be very difficult to overcome, such as the demographics, the corruption, etc. Russia wants to recreate Tsarist Russia. China, after World War II, lost a lot of land to Russia. Although they signed a treaty, it's not worth much. China has talked about reclaiming some of the land in Eastern Russia. That land could include Vladivostok. Right now, we see that in Eastern Russia, near the Chinese border, many of the cities and towns have schools that are taught in Mandarin. The people are ethnically Chinese looking, culturally Chinese, historically Chinese. Although Xi Jinping publicly has stated that they have peace. They're not fighting for that land. I have seen documents and talked to people that say behind the scenes, they see this as another great injustice. The Chinese built, I believe it's two pipelines from Siberia into China, supplying energy to that part of the country. Do you think that as China continues to grow, and I think they may be past some kind of critical point where they can sustain their economy, and Russia weakens to some extent just due to size of economies, do you think that we could see war of some type, either kinetic warfare or economic warfare between the two, especially over Eastern Russia?
Well, I'm not versed in the details of that, that border conflict, except that it's been ongoing for years. China, in terms of being an expansionist country, their population is beginning, they've reached the tipping point where their population is not only not growing slowly, it's shrinking. And by some estimates, in 50 years, it could have half the population that it has today. And so the demographic pressures to move people there or keep them there, I think, are not, it's not like they're bursting at the seams. And they also are bringing an awful lot of the peasants still into the cities. They have to have somebody to live in those empty cities that the engineers have built. I don't know. I mean, this is something that depends on the dexterity of the leader of Russia and the dexterity of Xi. And right now, Putin and Xi, and we saw it on display at this conference, seem to have a very close personal relationship. It doesn't seem to be just for the cameras. And they're, I think with those two occupying the jobs they're in now, I think the odds of that are a lot lower. But then we see, there's been talk about Xi, losing power. He's lost control of the military. It used to be report directly to him. Now it's going back to the traditional, sort of run by a committee. I don't know if Xi comes out of power and we end up with somebody that can't make that relationship work. I don't know. We could hear the guns. I don't, I bet it sounds like you may know. I'd be interested. Do you think we can? I mean,
I think it's a relationship right now of convenience. They need each other. It's also great for China to keep the West occupied that way. If China can continue to modernize its military over the coming years as it has been, it doesn't have to, as you know, it doesn't have to let contracts out like we do in the West. They can do what they want. They don't care about individual lives. They will move them around and have them do what they want. As you mentioned, the Uyghurs, the Tibetans, they will do what is best for the country, not what is best for the people of the country. The Communist Party has to survive, according to Xi Jinping. There is an anti-Xi clique in there, but is it strong enough to really say that we need to bring a Chinese form of capitalism to China? I don't really know that that's there yet. There's so much surveillance and AI work going on in China now. I don't know if they've passed a critical point where it can't be changed. It's a little
So
bit
I could, I
scary.
agree. Everything you said was smart. They're, and the Chinese, as I pointed out, you have to think of them as an engineering society, and they don't see people as people. They see people as units, and groups of people to be moved around. I mean, when they shut cities down during COVID, it was unbelievable. I mean, they locked people into their apartment buildings, and there was absolutely no humanity in their treatment of their own people. So, yeah, I mean that's very much real, and that has not changed though. Even under the communist, it's far worse. But it was still true in Imperial China that it treated its people that way. They thought about nothing about ordering people to move from one part of the country to the other without any consideration. I don't know. Counting on them to change their character is not likely, and I think we're more likely to be successful if we just find ways to keep them having reasons to engage with us and having reasons not to start a hot war.
How does our audience find out about the Bill Walton Show? Where do they watch it?
It's easy. Go to the BillWaltonShow.com, look it up on Rumble, look it up on Substack, look it up on just the Bill Walton Show. I started out calling the show On Common Ground. I thought that was a pretty fancy title. And then I discovered I couldn't find much common ground. I mean, and it's gotten worse. I mean, the sides are so divided now. I can't, in this country, we're really, we're at some tipping point now, particularly with the Charlie Kirk thing. Anyway, you can find me at the Bill Walton Show. That was my default title when I couldn't find that common ground.
Bill, always a great conversation. We look forward to our next one.
Yeah, great. I look forward to it and I'll learn a lot when I talk. Good questions. Thank you.
Take care now. One of the things that we have to worry about in China, of course, is the demographic issue, as you brought up, Daria. When you have a lot of young men who can't find jobs and who can't find wives and girlfriends, that's an explosive situation. Daria, let's go to our next guest. Salvador Litvak is the author of Let My People Laugh, Greatest Jewish Jokes of All Time, and the director of the upcoming action film Guns and Moses. Sal, welcome to the program.
Hello, Frank. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I had a friend who came back from Paris recently and said that walking on the Champs-Élysées wearing a Star of David jewelry, or heaven forbid, a yarmulke, was taking your life in your hands. Is France lost?
I would say it's all falling action now in most of Europe. I mean, it was just an easy invasion. No battles needed to be fought. And now you've got no-go zones in London and Paris, all kinds of places. It's unbelievable what's happened over there. And I think anti-Semitism is an obvious expression of that, but it's not the only one.
Sal,
Daria.
I just have to ask you this since you've been over there. How did this happen in such a short period of time? We have the Holocaust Museum here in Washington. We have politicians that, when I was a little bit younger, said, we can't forget the Holocaust. Yet, over in Europe, where it actually occurred, it seems like they've forgotten everything.
It's really just incredible. I mean, it's the oldest hatred that there is. Apparently, it's just been bristling below the surface for a long time. It just needed an excuse to come out. And since October 7th, which was, the saddest, worst day in history since the Holocaust, and we thought, what could be worse? Well, in many ways, it's become much worse. It's exactly what you're talking about. I mean, these Jew haters are brazen, proud, on the rooftops, shouting their Jew hatred for all to hear. They're just not tying their statements. Either they realize and they're just evil, or they don't realize that these statements are leading directly to violence against the Jews. And as I said before, it doesn't end with the Jews. Now you've got attacks on churches in America. What just happened to Charlie Kirk? That is a political movement that fueled this kid. It wasn't just some psycho out of nowhere. He's been indoctrinated with this kind of thinking for a long time, and sadly, he's not the only person out there who's been so indoctrinated.
If you look across the world, whether it's the hatred against Jews, including on our own college campuses, whether it's the attacks on Christians, particularly in the northern part of Africa, you see a movement against any type of expression of faith other than Islam, of course. At the same time, we've seen the rise of global socialism, global leftism. Isn't there a comparison between the rise of the global left and the attacks on people of faith?
Of course, absolutely. First of all, it is a kind of faith, right? That they're making up their own morality, and because it's a fake morality, they need to keep convincing themselves that it's true, over and over again, and shrieking at anybody who says, "Well, actually, there's eternal truths, there are eternal values. There's a morality that's existed in the world for thousands of years." And it directly contradicts what you're trying to foist on Americans and on a world population. And they know that they're on shaky ground. And so that makes them, that much more oppressive. The accusation confession of the left, it's like everything that they accuse the conservatives of is what they're doing, right? We see that over and over again. And especially this idea of being a tyrant and being a fascist. I mean, they will accept no dissenting opinions, but they really, they have miscalculated. And I wish Charlie was still with us. But I am reminded of that moment in the original Star Wars. You remember when Obi-Wan Kenobi says to Darth Vader, if you destroy me, you will create something more powerful than you can imagine. And I think that's going on right now. You've got so many people stepping up and saying, I can be silent no longer. And please God, that should be a powerful force for good and for change.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because it does seem like in the past week we have seen an incredible outpouring of people across the world. The amount of impact that one person can have is just amazing. And whether people are, I'm going to say rational people because I don't think the far progressive left is very rational. But if you look at rational people, whether they agree or disagree with Charlie Kirk and his opinions, it's the idea of the attack on free speech, on the freedom to hold an opinion and for it to be considered valued, not to be canceled. And I think, do you think that that is going to resonate enough in places like Europe, in France, and elsewhere? Where some of the immigration coming in from the Muslim world, for instance, where it is not tolerated to have other opinions, do you think that France could be saved in a sense from people recognizing that what happened here in Utah could happen there?
I have more hope for the United Kingdom, that march that they just had, and the news was saying it was 100,000 people, and it was probably a million or millions of people who are fed up, gives me some hope. But France, it's a proud and beautiful country with a wonderful and ancient history, and I hope that the French can rescue France for themselves. On the other hand, this is the people that to save their buildings, they just let Hitler march in. And Caroline Levitt, remember when she was asked, France wants the Statue of Liberty back? She said, yeah, we're not giving it back. And I will remind you that the only reason you're not speaking German is because of the United States of America.
one of the distinguishing features of the Judeo-Christian ethic is the value of the individual, that each individual has merit.
Good.
And that is so anathema to the global left. The concept of an individual having merit for himself, not being a cog in the wheel of society, but being valued because of just being a human, is anathema to so much of the left. Do you see that as being sort of the central fighting point between that global left and those of in the West?
Yeah, I mean, not only that the individual matters, but that the individual can achieve great heights through hard work and merit, right? They're so fixated on identity politics and that the most important thing about you is who you want to have sex with, what medical procedures you've had, what is the color of your skin, and just this total, shuttling aside of merit, America was built as a meritocracy. That is what we are all about. I think that, one of the things that was so important about Charlie was he was one of the few people that was constantly engaging with the other side and saying, okay, what are your ideas? Why do you believe what you believe? Now, this is why I disagree with you. And it's funny, Charlie was very familiar with the Jewish tradition. He was a devout Christian. But he knew that the New Testament, right, was the New Testament added on what we call the Hebrew Bible. Three quarters of the Christian Bible is the Hebrew Bible. And our tradition teaches very strongly that the fight, the quest for truth, is only happening in a hothouse, where people are really arguing and debating ideas. And our sages have taught for thousands of years, literally thousands of years, that in order to get at the truth, you have to interact with the people who disagree with you the strongest, and you have to be able to state their opinion before your own so that you show that you understand it, and in a way that they will say, yes, that's my opinion. But do we see that in modern culture where people are going to be able to restate the opinions of the other side without snark, without sarcasm, and to say, okay, what I hear you saying is, and I think you believe it because, is that correct? And if you state it fairly, then they'll say yes. Now, when you do that, you set the stage for a real conversation. You show them that they're heard, and now they might listen to you. That is something that Charlie lived and breathed. That's what he was all about. And it's so rare in our society. And that's the guy that they assassinated, probably because his ideas were so strong and his process was so transparent that it was attracting huge numbers of people to the truth, especially young people. And that's what was so threatening, I think, to the other side.
Before I go to Daria, can we say that the left's penchant for violence is because their ideas simply don't do well in that marketplace of ideas? That when you look at 100 years or so of socialism failing, every place it's been tried, in every manner it's been tried, whether you're talking about communist socialism or indeed national socialism, it's always failed. And when your ideas can't stand on their own two legs, well, you punch the other guy down so he can't come back with a better argument.
100%. I could not agree more with that. And I can speak a little bit personally because my mom was Hungarian.
Okay.
She was a survivor of the Holocaust that my grandmother carried as an infant through a concentration camp. My grandfather murdered in a different camp. And after the war, they were in Budapest. And then they traded the Soviets for the Nazis. It was a little bit of an upgrade, but not that much. And they finally got out of Hungary in 56, followed a relative, and ended up in Chile, which is where my father's family had been since the beginning of the 20th century, having fled the pogroms in Ukraine. So in Chile, in 1970, you had a socialist, really a communist president, Salvador Allende, elected. And so two things happened. The first is the Hungarian side of the family is like, we've seen this movie before. We know how it plays out. We got to get out of this country. And my father said, yeah, but it was democratically elected. How long is this really going to last? We'll see. Let's not be in such a hurry. And then they were very young. My father's just a couple of years out of college. And he got a call. He had been involved with some communist, club in college, right? So he got a call from the guy who's 2 years ahead of him at the college. Was the president of the Communist Club when he was just, going to some meetings. And this guy says, come in for a meeting. We want to offer you a job. He goes in for the meeting and they're basically offering, he's 24 years old, and they're offering him something like Undersecretary of the Interior, Undersecretary of Transportation, something like that. He's an engineer. And he's like, I mean, normally a person with that, this job would be working in that field for 30 years. Why are you offering it to me? And the guy says, because we don't have anybody. Everybody in this government is new and young and idealistic and believes in communism, but have no experience running a country. So we need somebody smart like you. So my father says, oh, thank you. I'll think about it. Went home and said, Kathy, we're getting the hell out of this country. This government is going to fall apart so fast. They're totally incompetent. I have no idea what they're doing. And sure enough, 3 years later, that government collapsed, as every communist entity does. Maybe the Chinese experiment in communism is the longest lasting, but that's not just communism. That's sheer tyranny, right? I mean, the Chinese Communist Party is running everything. And the only reason that it is somewhat successful is because they are engaging in commerce, right? They just, are running it top and bottom and using all kinds of unfair international practices, but still they're borrowing from capitalism, I think, to buttress what they call communism.
Sal, I want to ask you a real serious question. Given what you just told me about your family history, and given the events of this past week, we see that the United States is a near future-oriented country. We don't really think long term. We forget about things and we move on to the next event in social media or on TV or whatever. We need to learn from history so we don't repeat things, and we don't seem to do it. We just seem to, for a short time, whether it's after 9/11, become united and patriotic, and then we go back to our old ways. Was the Charlie Kirk incident enough? It reverberated not just in the US, but around the world. We saw that the chapters went from 3,000 chapters in the US to over 30,000 new requests for chapters. Do you see this as being able to make it past the evening news in the fall, or is it going to just be an issue that disappears?
Such a good question. I was very moved by that, right? All these requests for new chapters. I was really impressed by that. We also, my wife and I also made a movie about Abraham Lincoln. And to make that movie, Saving Lincoln, we did such a deep dive. We did years of research on the Civil War, its causes, what it was like to live through that conflagration, and the aftermath. And Lincoln himself was so mindful of the idea that he was entrusted to shepherd the American experiment forward through its greatest crisis, and that the American experiment was not just on behalf of America. It truly is a shining light in the world. And if you think about it, now most countries are at some level of democracy, right? They're at least call themselves a democracy. That was not the case, right? The American experiment led the way. There was no real democracy before that. So I think that we've built something here which is crucial, which will last, which will survive. And I just think that there's something about the American spirit that will not let it fail. And I think we're all very quick, yes, to be caught up in our own affairs. And as Robert Frost, the great poet, said, and they, since they were not the ones dead, turned to their affairs. But I think we're all feeling like we're living in historic times, that we are at a critical juncture. And so I think that every time in America has faced that kind of emergency, enough people step up that we just won't let it fail. And if right now requires vigilance and historicity and being mindful of history and taking lessons from history, then I think enough of us will do it. That's my prayer. I really hope that we will do that, because the world can't afford for America to fail. And I don't think we're anywhere near failure. But it is also true that, the Hungarian side of my family said, don't you think that what happened in Hungary and Germany and Poland and Czechoslovakia and everywhere can't happen in America? It could happen here too. And we would think, okay, Grandma, I understand you were traumatized, you lived through that. But that kind of Jew hatred and just outright racism, it has no place in America. That couldn't happen in America. I'm not
Yeah.
saying we're 1930s Germany, but are we living through the most dangerous time for the Jews that we've ever known in our lifetime? Certainly.
All four of my grandparents came from Hungary. Family left at different periods in time. And my grandmother always said that you've got to remember history. But Europe is past oriented. It has a long history. We don't have that history. And it seems to me that the schools today are not teaching history.
By
How can,
design, they've been
by
hijacked.
design?
They've been
Yeah.
hijacked. Absolutely. Can I say something? I live here in LA. We have a wonderful cleaning lady. She comes twice a week. She's like a member of the family. We really care about her. We've known her for years. She has a young son who goes to elementary school in East LA. She's Guatemalan. This is a Latino neighborhood. All of the students at that elementary school are Latino. Either they're coming from El Salvador or Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, etc. We gave her a hat that came from some Jewish fundraiser. My friend runs an organization called High Society. It's just the word high in Hebrew, which means life, on a hat. But it's two Hebrew letters on a hat. The kid wears the hat to school. He got bullied because he was wearing a baseball hat that had Hebrew letters on it. If that wasn't bad enough, a few weeks later, we heard that the teacher took all the kids to a pro-Palestine rally. This is a public school, an elementary school. What is this teacher doing, taking Latino students to a pro-Pali rally to indoctrinate them in this radical hatred? There's no place for that. It's unbelievable that something like that is going on, and you can bet that if it's happening in that school, it must be happening in hundreds, if not thousands, of schools. Yeah,
Unbelievable.
it used to be that teacher was like the most respectable profession. They were my heroes. I mean, people who spend their time teaching kids, teaching the next generation, good values, civics, things like that. That's long gone. Now it's some kind of indoctrination opportunity into their leftist policies.
But you know what the
So
really
how do we
cool
get to
thing
see
is?
Guns N' Roses? Oh,
Ah, that's
yeah.
a great question. Thank you. So we just wrapped up our theatrical run. It's actually still playing in South Florida for anyone in the Del Rey area. But we're all looking forward to, I won't announce the date officially, but it's October. It'll happen in October that we're going to be streaming everywhere. iTunes, Amazon, buy or rent the movie. It's going to be available to everybody. We're so excited that everyone's going to get a chance to see it. Because people are so excited to see our movie. It's a great edge of your seat, pulse pounding action thriller about a heroic Hasidic rabbi who becomes a reluctant warrior after his community is violently attacked, starring Mark Feuerstein, Neil McDonough, the legendary Christopher Lloyd, Dermot Mulroney, Ilona Tal, Jake Busey, amazing cast. And, it's a movie about Jews under attack who fight back. Listen, my job as a director is to entertain you. That's the most important thing about it. It's an entertaining film, a great thriller. But we conceived it and shot it long before October 7th. And so we knew Jews under attack who fight back would always be relevant. We could not have imagined the world that the movie would be coming to market in. And if I may just add one more thing about it. We are in a culture war. We see it obviously in the news media. We've seen it in the universities, in academia, but don't think it's not happening in the entertainment world, right? All these Hollywood actors, pledging to never work with Israel, and really they mean Jews. And our movie, with our theatrical footprint and our cast and our timeliness, and our 95 audience score on Rotten Tomatoes. That should be buttressed with 200 reviews. It only has 11, right? Because they can't say it's a bad movie. They know it's a good movie. So they're trying to ignore it, memory hold it. And that's why the word of mouth and shows like yours, and just letting people know about this movie and how much fun they're going to have is so important. So please, everybody, as soon as Guns N' Roses becomes available to you, go see it. I promise you'll have a great time and then share the love. Let your friends know that you enjoyed that movie so they find out about it too.
Fantastic. So let me be the first to wish you a good Rosh Hashanah.
Oh, man, thank you so much, brother. May this new year bring us all joy, health, light, meaning. Please keep up your good work, telling the truth. I said it on the day that Charlie died. They took such an important truth teller from us, but 1,000 truth tellers will
You'll
rise
have
in
to
its
come back.
place.
You'll have to come back.
Oh, man.
We'll speak
Anytime.
again, Sal. Take care.
All the best.
Yeah.
Take care. And to our audience, thanks for tuning in today.
We welcome our newest radio affiliate in Tucson, Arizona at 95.5 FM, in Provo, Utah at 90.5 FM, and in Washington, D.C. at 96.7 FM. They join Las Vegas, Nevada at 92.1 FM, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 1640 AM and 102.1 FM, Tampa, Florida, 92.1 FM. Ritchie, Florida, 88.3 FM. Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 90.3 FM. Macon, Georgia, 810 AM and 98.3 FM. Boulder, Colorado, 100.7 FM. Long Beach, California, 101.5 FM. And in Pittsburgh at 107.3 FM. We're also available on the AMFM247.com, iHeart, Spreaker, and the Conservative Commandos. Tell Alexa to play the program. Tune into our television show, The American Political Zone, on the AUN Network, Roku, and Public Broadcast TV. You can access either program on our website at usagovpolicy.com. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week. We're sponsored by the New York Analysis of Policy and Government, a division of the American Analysis of News and Media, Inc., at usagovpolicy.com and the Institute for American Politics. Email us at truthinradio@gmail.com and tune into the American Political Zone television show, also on the AMFM247.com network.
The producer and director is the brilliant Jeff Hansen.